Thanks very much, Vajratara. First of all, I just want to say how amazing it is that I'm in Sheffield at all, giving a talk. I don't usually have the opportunity to act spontaneously. I kind of live in this weird world that some of us have in our Western Buddhist order, where, you know, people get out their diaries and kind of plan the whole year, which I think is completely wrong and does violence to, you know, creative energies and all that. But it, kind of this possibility kind of came up of giving a talk here this evening, and I thought, well, it's a kind of crazy thing to do, to go on those incredibly, interminably long train journeys from Norwich to Sheffield to give a talk, so it's worth doing. So anyway, that's why I'm here. And it's fantastic to come to this centre. It's the first time I've been to it, and it's a really, really wonderful centre. I mean, the atmosphere here is really very warm and pleasant. You know, it's not just nicely, beautifully, you know, done out. It's got a really good atmosphere, which, you know, tells me it's a very, very good sangha, a thriving sangha. So I'm very pleased to be here. Bit of an adventure for me to come here to the north of England from the east of England. I don't get out much. Hold this idea. Last night I was with a very dear friend of mine named Arloka. Some of you might know him. He paints pictures of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and that sort of thing. And we're quite close friends. And he was asking me what I was going to speak about, and I told him some of the general areas. And he said, yeah, we image our desires. We image our desires. So just hold that thought, perhaps, throughout the talk. We image our desires. And Vajratara mentioned this word, yidam, which is a Tibetan word, which literally means one bound by an oath, an oath-bound one. And this refers to particular deities that you take at the time of initiation, and along with the initiation you take various oaths, various vows to do the practice, and, you know, so many times and so on and so forth. Now, this Tibetan term yidam, and meditation upon yidams and initiation into yidams are very important in Tibetan Buddhism, in Tantric Buddhism generally. This term yidam is very much a rendering of the Sanskrit ishta devata, which Lochana told me just before the talk means the chosen or wished for or desired for deity. So this term is Sanskrit ishta devata, and this goes back to the Indian tantric tradition, where, again, you know, you'd go to your teacher, or in the very early, the origins of the tantra, the way it's presented, sometimes the teacher might just turn up. You have a very strange encounter, and in the course of that encounter, he initiates you into a particular Buddha figure or Bodhisattva figure or Dakini figure, a sort of sky-going goddess figure. All of these images, of course, all of these symbols, all of these beings, embodiments of enlightenment, the enlightened mind itself. And it's interesting, it's called the chosen, the wished for, the desired for deity, because, it fits in, that notion fits in very well with the talk. In the tantric tradition, some of these figures are very weird and wonderful indeed, and, you know, really quite strange and perhaps quite hard for us to relate to. In our context, in the context of the Western Buddhist order, we have a similar thing going on in principle, when at the time we are ordained, the first part of that ordination ceremony is called a private ordination ceremony, and you go alone to your preceptor. There's just you and the preceptor, the person who conducts this private ordination. You go alone. It symbolizes that you're willing to follow the path to enlightenment, even if nobody else was doing so. Whatever else whatever anybody else was doing, even if they were anti-following the Buddhist path, you would still follow the Buddhist path. It's a very, very important part of the ordination. That's the first part. The second part is the public ordination, where you're received into, you enter into, happily, joyfully, into a spiritual community. Now, as part of that private ordination ceremony, you are, how can we say, let's use the word, initiated into the mantra of a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva, which you choose. Well, I say you choose. Sometimes it can feel as though it's choosing you. Or it could be that you request your preceptor to choose it for you. There are many different ways in which, you know, you take up a particular practice. This mantra part of the private ordination is very important. It symbolizes your particular connection, your particular way in to enlightenment, your particular way into it. Something, you know, very particular to you. So obviously it's something very, you know, very effective, even you could say very powerful, very potent, if you like. That mantra initiation and the meditations that go with it are a kind of gateway, a symbol, an image, a myth, a gateway into a symbol, an image, a myth, and a realm. Very, very rich area indeed. So in our own order, the different Buddhas, the most popular Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are figures like Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, Manjugosha, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, Vajrapani, the Bodhisattva of energy, Tara, the Bodhisattva who embodies the quintessence of compassion, Padmasambhava, and so on. There are many different forms. And these forms are very beautiful. They have lovely colours, different colours. They have all sorts of symbolic associations. They hold different implements, and so on and so forth. Now, some people wonder why we have all this. Some people, you know, periodically it comes up, you know, why do we have all this stuff? Well, the short answer to that is that meditating on a form, on an image, on colour, and so on, it activates, if you like, your ardent desire, or even the expression of your ardent desire to gain enlightenment. And an image, a symbol, activates that, transforms that, takes that far more effectively than any set of ideas could ever do. Some people, though, are still not convinced. They want a very kind of stripped down, or even have an idea that Buddhism is really stripped down and very simple, and that the Buddha, you know, was really, you know, in a way a good Protestant, you know what I mean? He sort of, you know, rites and rituals as ends in themselves, you know, you don't want to get hung up on these things, and, you know, didn't he go against the gods and all that sort of thing? So what of all these images and symbols and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that you have in Buddhism? What have they got to do with anything? Aren't they just a fantasy? Games? You know, the sort of Buddhist equivalent of reading Harry Potter, or, you know, I don't know, ways to distract yourself in different ways. Well, some people might not think Harry Potter is distraction, so to be a bit careful. Ways to avoid reality, in other words. But we need to look again, if we're going to get into this, and we need to go back to the Buddha himself in the earliest texts. Because in the earliest texts of Buddhism, in the suttas and the other collections of the Pali scriptures, what comes over is the overwhelming presence of the Buddha. He's not just somebody who goes around giving little homilies and giving sermons and sort of ticking people off and creating rules and regulations. That is not the way he appears and the way he stands and sits and moves and lies down in the old texts. And even in the very human accounts, you get this presence, this, you know, as it were, real presence of the Buddha, which is incredibly beautiful. I'll just give you a few examples. One of one of the loveliest of suttas, is called Bahir of the Bark Cloth, or Bahir of the Bark Garment. Don't worry, he didn't go around wearing, you know, bark, pine bark. It was probably some sort of fibre he wore. But Bahir was a wanderer of another tradition. We're not quite sure what. And for one reason or another, he ended up walking across India, hundreds and hundreds of miles, to find the Buddha who he'd heard about and to receive a teaching from him to gain enlightenment. And he was so determined, he even went to the Buddha on his begging round to ask for the teaching, which, you know, you didn't do, but he was so determined. And the text describes how Bahir sees the Buddha. Just a few lines. When he sees the Buddha walking mindfully round the great city of Shravasti, it says, comely he was, goodly to look upon, with senses calmed, like a trained, well-trained, perfectly trained elephant. I know that could sound anticlimactic, but in the Indian tradition, that is a very, very beautiful, you know, it's a very, very beautiful image. But, you know, notice those words, comely he was, goodly to look upon. You know, Bahir sees the Buddha immediately. He doesn't, other people would have seen, a rather grizzled monk walking around begging for his food. Bahir sees the Buddha. He sees, if you like, the real Buddha. If you like, the Buddha in his, you know, in his true nature, with his, all his spiritual glory, all his majesty, all his beauty, if you like. And eventually he entreats the Buddha from the depths of his heart to teach him, and the Buddha refuses. He says, you know, I don't teach when I'm begging my food. But Bahir is so determined, and, you know, he makes a real plea, because, you know, you don't know what might happen. You know, you might die, I might die. And then the Buddha gives this famous teaching, a very stripped back teaching, which begins with the words, in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only the heard. Just a few words. And Bahir is enlightened. He becomes an arahant just on hearing these words. But, you know, we read the words, you know, hundreds of times, and kind of nothing's happening. And of course, Bahir becomes enlightened because he's receiving it from the very being who embodies that realization. That's what in the seen only the seen, in the heard only the heard, and so on, actually looks like. This majestic, beautiful, glorious being, full of depth, and yes, like this great elephant before you. So that's one example of the Buddha's presence. Another one I really like this one. It's not a well-known. This is a well-known one. This is the story of Vakali. And Vakali, I think he was a bit younger than the Buddha. I'm not quite sure when it happened. Basically, Vakali fell in love with the Buddha. In the sense that, you know, when the Buddha was around, he'd kind of go passive. And, you know, and the Buddha would have been such a very attractive presence. And he was just, you know, just sort of stunned, you know, and he couldn't sort of think straight, couldn't meditate properly. Just completely stunned by the presence of the Buddha. And the Buddha just said, go into retreat. You know, get away from me. You know, go into retreat and meditate. But they didn't have a discussion about the feelings involved. They didn't sort of share their responses and, you know, anything like that. They didn't form a little group to talk about the Buddha's relationship with Vakali. No. You know, go into retreat, get over it. You know, get on with your practice, get away from me. And Vakali is, you know, he's completely smitten, he's completely in love, and he's having all sorts of visions of the Buddha, and these visions are appearing and telling him, said, no, you shouldn't be looking at us, you know, get on with your practice, stop being so distracted and all the rest of it. It's really fantastic. Eventually, Vakali gains enlightenment, he becomes an arhat, and, but very sadly, he gets some sort of illness. And he starts to die, starts the process of dying. And when he's dying, he calls to his fellow monks and says, "One thing I'd love more than anything else before I die is to see the Master again. I'd love to see the Buddha again." And the Buddha came. And it's a very, very touching moment when the Buddha comes to Vakali. And Vakali says, "You know, I just wanted to see you before I pass away." And the Buddha says, I think very tenderly, you could read it in a very sort of strict way, but I don't read it like that. The Buddha says, "Why, Vakali, do you focus just on this body? Focus on the Dhamma. Focus on reality. Focus on the truth. And then he says, "He who sees the Dhamma sees me." So what I think the Buddha is pointing to there with Vakali, look towards this, not Dhamma in the sense of a collection of teachings, but the sort of vastness of reality, the vastness of consciousness that you only glimpse a little bit of in the physical body of the Buddha. Now, these sorts of experiences don't just happen in the Buddha's presence in the Pali Canon. They happen when he's not present. Another very beautiful sutta is called the Pingya Sutta from a section of the Sutta Nipata called The Way to the Beyond. And Pingya is an old Brahmin who lives a long way away from where the Buddha teaches, and it seems that he had some contact with the Buddha when he was a young man. And he loves the Buddha. He's full of faith and devotion in the Buddha and his teaching. And he talked quite a bit about it. And one man said, "Well, if he's so good, this Buddha, why aren't you with him all the time? How can you stay away from him?" And Pingya said, "Ah, sir," he says, "sir, I'm old. Physically, I can't travel that far. I can't go to where the Master is staying. But he's with me all the time. I recollect him all the time." The language they use is mindfulness. It's sati, recollecting, remembering the presence of the Buddha. And he says, "I don't just see him all the time. I don't just recollect him all the time. All night long, I spend each night revering him." So it's as if every night he's sitting, as it were, in the presence of the Buddha, revering him. And as the sutta goes on, Pingya gains liberation through this. Through meditating on the Buddha, who's not present, but who is within his consciousness. There's another lovely story from the commentarial tradition, where Ananda, the Buddha's faithful friend and attendant, after the Parinibbana, goes from Kushinagra back to the Jeta Grove at Shravasti, and he goes to the Gandakuti, the perfumed chamber where the Buddha used to stay. And Ananda goes into the perfumed chamber, he sweeps it out, he puts out water, he sets out a seat, and he sits as if the Master is there. He sits all day and all night as if the Master is there. He carries on as if the Master is still there. He's still attending the Buddha. There is a nice little commentarial note, perhaps not so nice, where it said, well, Ananda was, you know, a bit attached. I don't think so. I think this is actually a spiritual practice going on. How else would he remember enlightenment but in the form of his teacher? How else would that be? How else could that be than to remember him as if he is there? So all these things that I'm mentioning makes it clear that the Buddha in the earliest texts isn't just a figure of flesh and blood. He's a presence in the consciousness of his disciples. A presence, an image, a form, enlightenment in human form, present within the consciousness of his disciples. And it's perfectly natural, it's essentially human, I would say, to think of enlightenment as a person. It's a completely natural part of our being in the world to bring other people to mind. So why should it be any different in relation to our highest and deepest values and principles and ideals, enlightenment? I remember, this is the sort of thing that you come across in India, a lovely thing that happened in India with a very dear friend of mine who passed away some years ago, named Shakyanand, who was a huge order member. He was really, really fat, I think that's the word you can use. And he was a very, very lovely man, and he was quite old when I met him, and he devoted his life to spreading the Dharma, Buddhism, in a part of Maharashtra state where there'd been very little Buddhist activity. He just devoted himself to that. And he took me on he asked me to go on a tour with him once, and you know, he had us doing, you know, me doing about 4 talks a day all over the place. It was exhausting. But in the house he was staying in, he took me to a corner of this room with his shrine in it, and he said, he was sitting on a cushion, and there was a cushion opposite him, and he said, "Padmavajra, this is where I have my order meeting. This is where I have..." Every week, members of the order get together for what we call a chapter meeting. Now, Shakyanand was the only order member in this town, so I said, "Oh, Shakyanand, this is where you have your chapter meeting. How do you have your chapter meeting?" He said, "On that seat, Bhante comes." Sangharakshita, our teacher, who ordained him, who he had great devotion for, and he comes, and we sit together. And that's our order meeting. And he meant it. This wasn't some sort of blind faith. This wasn't any kind of weird thing going on. There was a reality to this and a purity to it that was incredibly moving. So yes, I would say it's essentially human. We're people. We have a human body, a human consciousness. We have a particular human shape that fills space. And that's very important to us, our human shape, our personhood. We cherish it very much. So, of course, it's perfectly natural to see our highest and deepest spiritual principles in that very form, in that human form, in a perfectly beautiful, majestic human form. So it's not a degeneration to have these forms. It's an expression of what is natural to us, to what we actually do with our minds and hearts. One of the things that you do when you take up meditation on a Buddha or Bodhisattva is you do a thing called visualizing the form of the Buddha or Bodhisattva. You imagine the presence of the form in front of you. And a lot of people say, "Well, I can't visualize. I can't imagine." And of course, that's complete nonsense. It's a completely ridiculous thing to say. I mean, everybody's had the experience of sitting, you know, in one place in meditation. And there they are, in this room, say. You're there. You might even be doing it now. Well, you're here in the room, but actually, your mind's elsewhere. And, you know, you're not just thinking about it, you're there. You know, you're actually, I caught some people out. Some people are actually not here listening to me give the talk. That's all right, I don't mind. I can talk to an empty room on some days. But you're actually there. You're away with the fairies. You're doing that thing tomorrow. You're actually doing it. So, you know, the important thing is to, you know, we've got to get hold of that faculty. It's very powerful. We need to harness that power to concentrate the entire consciousness on what is most meaningful. That's what we need to do. We need to take that incredibly, in a way it's a magical aspect of, you know, the human mind, that we can be somewhere else when we're here. I know some people say, you know, be in the present. Yeah, well, yeah, all right. But actually it's a very wonderful thing that you know, our minds can do this. But you've got to get hold of it. You've got to use it. You've got to build on it and develop it. This is, this is one of the things that the tantric tradition are so good on. Well, Buddhism generally, but the tantric tradition sort of specialise in it, in taking something that we do, And maybe it's leading us into areas that, you know, aren't very good. And using it as a spiritual practice. And there's a lovely story of a Mahasiddha, a king who's incredibly wealthy. And he loves jewels. And he spends most of his time just sort of completely captivated by these jewels that he's got. And one day a yogi, I don't think he even says his name, he just comes in and he just says, "I'm richer than you." And the king says, "Oh yeah?" You know, and you know, he then kind of does a cryptic comment about the great bliss that he's always experiencing. And the king is intrigued. And eventually the yogi says, "All right, you like jewels. Well, I'll show you how to really like jewels if you really want to get into them." So he gets him to look at his favourite jewel. And he teaches him a way of meditating on that jewel and to see its real nature and to internalise it and so on and so forth. To reflect on its nature, that it's dazzling but empty and so on. So we need to take these faculties that we have and use them in our practice. And particularly find the image, the images, the stories, the myths, the colours, the sounds, the things that you respond to. And connect them with the Dharma. Connect them with your highest aspirations. If you're responding to something, that means something. You know, if you're having a strong response to a particular colour, or a particular form, or a particular story, or a particular image, it's telling you something. Always ask yourself, if you're having trouble with meditation, you know, you're spacing out, you're bored, find interest. What are you interested in? I mean, it might be things which, you know, might not be very appropriate to follow, but that's another point where we won't go there. But, you know, find what's interesting. They're golden threads to connect you to much deeper places in the Dharma. This is, of course, an intuitive process. It's not something you just, you know, think out. It's looking for your responses. A friend of mine, well, my friend Aloka, again, he's been encouraging me to paint in the sense of making a mess. You know, being a kid again, basically, making a mess on lots of pieces of paper. And what I've been doing the last few days is like painting loads and loads of pictures with just basically variations on red and black. Now that means something. That means that I don't know what it means. It might not mean anything, but it's worth pushing it and pushing it and pushing it to see where one will arrive. So you might notice, as you get into Buddhism, that you have a particular response to a particular form, to the Buddha himself, to a particular bodhisattva, to a particular mantra. You don't know why. You just feel this attraction, this fascination. It shouldn't be like, "Oh, I need to meditate on Manjugosha because he's the bodhisattva of wisdom and I'm not very good at study." I mean, it's not illegitimate entirely, but that isn't, you know, that's taking it in the wrong way. You go with what you're desiring. That's what you go with. Okay. So I want to see how this might work out in practice, in actual practice. And I want to try to take a look at what it means to meditate on a symbolic form, on an image, and what you might go through in that process. So I'm going to describe a bit about meditating on a particular form. Before you can meditate on a particular symbolic form, a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva, you have to make a deep spiritual commitment. It's a serious endeavour. It's not a game, like I said. It's not a fantasy. These images, you know, are reflections of the deepest nature of things. So there's a commitment to the practice. You also need to awaken loving kindness for all beings, because you're not doing it to escape from your connections with others. You're actually doing it to connect much more deeply with others. You also need to reflect on the nature of existence, the nature of life, particularly its arising and ceasing and its essentially empty and insubstantial nature. You're trying to sort of enter into this much more open-ended vision of life. And that reflection turned into imagining a vast expanse of blue sky in all directions. Well, it's really more like entering into vast, open, unending, deep blue space. You sort of lose yourself in blue space. And in this particular meditation I'm going to describe, what arises out of the blue space is a red lotus. A red lotus. And resting on the red lotus is a pure, white, luminous mat, but it's a mat made of the moon. So it's like a white moon lying flat on a red lotus. And lying flat above the white moon mat is a fiery orange sun disk. So you've got a sort of cushions on this throne, the moon and sun. Symbolism. I won't say what it means. And the mood in doing this is one of great receptivity and openness, feminine in a way, if you like that sort of language. Another way I like to see it when you imagine a lotus throne like this is that you're becoming the perfect host. The perfect host. You're entering into a sort of state of courtesy in relation to what's going to arise. And what's going to arise here is the image, the being in this case, of Guru Padmasambhava, the lotus-born guru, also known as Guru Rinpoche, the greatly precious guru. And he manifests out of the space, magically, spontaneously, and like wonderful splashes of colour. And that takes form, and he's like a great king. And he's in a particular seated position known as Raja Lilasana, or royal ease. So his left leg is drawn up, and his right is sort of playfully hanging down. So he's at rest, he's at play. And what the first thing you notice is that he's sort of enveloped in different robes. So he's wearing a deep blue, royal blue robe of a king, a kingly robe. Around that he's wearing the yellow patched, or the red and yellow patched robe of the monk, the renunciate. Interesting symbolism. The blue robe of the king, you know, worldly power. Red and yellow patched robe of a renunciate. And around them all he's wearing a richly embroidered red outer robe, which is of a bodhisattva, the being who works for the liberation of all beings. So he's enveloped in these robes, which are all communicating something. His left hand is resting in meditation on his lap, and in that hand he's holding a skull cup, a skull bowl, a white bleached skull bowl, and it's filled with red swirling nectar. Amrita, the nectar of the deathless state. And that red nectar is swirling up in the skull bowl. So a little bit of shorthand symbolism. The skull bowl symbolizes spiritual death, shunyata. And the amrita, the great bliss nectar, it's the great bliss. It's the great bliss that you drink when you undergo spiritual death. I'll have something to say about the skull bowl and the nectar in a minute. And he holds that very easily, very lightly in that left hand. And in his right hand he's holding a vajra, which is a diamond scepter thunderbolt. It's golden. And it's an implement of great transforming power. You know, to really hold a vajra, you have, you know, the power to transform whatever arises. And on his head he's got a wonderful red lotus cap. It's a sort of, well, if you haven't seen one, they're very hard to describe. It's like a sort of crown cap. But it is like it's got four petals, four flaps. A wonderful thing, the lotus cap. And he's got a beautiful face. majestic. He's smiling, but also he's got a slight frown at the same time. He's got this, what they call a wrathful smile. It's a very, very subtle expression. You know, he's smiling and yet there's this kind of wrath. But don't misunderstand, he's not uptight. He's not angry in the way we understand that word. It's more like he's so full of bliss. He's so, you know, so focused, you know, on the way things are. So focused on the activity of, you know, bringing the Dharma to others. So in it, that it kind of makes his face look, as it were, wrathful. He's got long eyes, beautiful eyes, lovely black jet eyes. And he's got long, shiny black locks. And there's light radiating from the whole figure. He's got a green halo around his head and he's got a sort of rainbow aura. And in the crook of his left arm, he's holding a trident, which is like a sort of companion to him. And that's, you know, that's too detailed to go into all the descriptions of that. But, well, just to say, it's a flaming three-pronged trident with a skull on it, a slightly rotting head, a freshly severed head, streamers, danglers, you know, etc. And when you see this in meditation, you're looking to see it as though it's made of light. You don't see it as opaque or flat. You're seeing it as though it's made of light. It's, you know, diaphanous, like a rainbow, like a mirage. Very vivid, very real. This is what you're looking for. But, you know, completely translucent. That's what you're looking for. That's what you're trying, as it were, to achieve. And you gaze on this vision in the meditation, lovingly, cherishing every part. And you find the connection, or the connections. You find the connections to hold the image there. You try to see as well, not as if the figure's like a kind of little postcard, kind of pasted behind your eyeballs. You're trying to see it from there with the eye of the heart, to use the Sufi expression. You're trying to see it with the eye of the heart. Reminds me of that Plotinus thing. The eye can see the sun because there's something of the sun in the eye. And the mood that you're cultivating in a practice like this is in a way of the loving disciple for the beloved teacher. And in the Tibetan Nyingma tradition in particular, who specialise in meditating on Padmasambhava, you need to adopt the feeling, even see yourself, as one of Padmasambhava's Dakini disciples, one of his female disciples. Whether you're a man or a woman makes no difference. So you're trying to get into the mood of being Mandarava or Yeshe Tsogyal. Mandarava, his main Indian disciple, and Yeshe Tsogyal, his main Tibetan disciple. You're adopting an attitude, of intense spiritual aspiration and loving appreciation. That's what you're opening up to when you're meditating on this figure. And in the life of Padmasambhava, you get Mandarava praising Padmasambhava as the healing power of love. Dazzling, joyful epiphany. Phrases like that. And she goes on to lovingly describe every feature of Padmasambhava. His eyebrows, his eyes, his long locks and so on. It's really incredible. His deep, ecstatic eyes. His skin, the colour of the purple of seashells and so on. It's incredibly sensuous, actually. So you're looking to develop an intense interest and desire in the practice. That's what you're looking to do. It's completely safe space, if you're worried about this, to do all this. So, and all the features of the image are meaningful. Then this is not just a pretty picture, you know, for a bit of entertainment on a rainy day. All everything present are gateways, doorways, openings into the realm of enlightenment itself, enlightened consciousness, bodhicitta, great bodhicitta, wisdom and compassion in all its depth. So when you daily meditate on a form like this, over time, flashes of illumination start to come through. So let's just take an example. supposing you're meditating on this form. So every day you're meditating on a skull bowl, a skull cup. Every day you're looking at a bone skull cup. Okay, it's made of light, but it's a bone skull cup. So daily you're contemplating impermanence, death, ending, loss. The fact that everything is failing, breaking up, and breaking apart. You're actually looking at death. And the skull cup has so many symbolic associations in the Padmasambhava tradition. It evokes the cremation ground. He spent a lot of time in cremation ground. So it's bringing all that into your meditation. So every day you're taking that into your consciousness. And of course it's the most basic Buddhist insight, this. That everything that lives will die. That if it's a beginning thing, it's an ending thing. And of course this can be very painful to contemplate. It can feel very, you can even start to get a bit sad when you start to contemplate this. Can be even frightening to contemplate this. And that's why it's so important to contemplate these things within this very beautiful and positive context. But it is very poignant, isn't it, that, you know, all the effort that we make in life, all the, you know, the effort that we put into, you know, friendships and, you know, to do really good things like, you know, this centre, it's all going to pass away. And, you know, if it doesn't, then we will. Now, all this, when you think like that, it could be depressing. It could lead to a sort of nihilistic, you know, take on things. But remember, the skull cup, you're not just seeing the skull cup. It's not empty. It's filled with this red swirling nectar, this great bliss nectar, this Amrit nectar, this deathless nectar. And this nectar, this swirling nectar, is the spiritual rebirth that comes when you spiritually die, when you really take in the impermanence and ending nature of all things. When you do that, you really take it in, that turns into the nectar of spiritual rebirth. So let's see how this might start to manifest a little bit in experience. Well, I think first of all it might start to express itself, this great bliss nectar, as a sort of deep longing, strangely enough. Yeshe Tsogyal is I've mentioned identifying with Padmasambhava's disciples, and Yeshe Tsogyal, his Tibetan disciple, gives expression to incredible longing to see the teacher when he leaves Tibet. It's a very, very beautiful kind of song of longing to the teacher. You know, so perhaps this spiritual rebirth begins where, out of that sense of, yeah, well, everything is going to pass away, arises a longing, a deep longing and yearning. Well, for what? For something that transcends that, or some sense of meaning in relation to all that? The other thing that I think that can that this is related to is that, you know, through contemplating the skull bowl, that samsara, this life, is fragile, very fragile, and short in the general scheme of things, but very, very precious too. Very, very precious that we have this life. So this longing is in relation to this preciousness of our life and really doing something with this, our life. So you have this genre of Tibetan literature called calling the Lama from afar. Calling the Lama from afar. And the context is, you've sort of seen through, you know, all the sort of games that you play, and you've recognised, yes, actually, life is all impermanent. And this great longing arises to call on your teacher, to call on this sublime spiritual form. There's an incredible thing in the life of Milarepa where he finds his mother's old bones and he sits on her bones, uses them as a meditation seat, and calls to all the sort of spiritual powers to inspire him in his spiritual endeavour. The nectar of great bliss, so longing is perhaps the beginning of this great bliss arising in the skull bowl, but it might come in other ways. The great bliss, the Mahasukha, is also the great love, the Mahamaitri. It's all-pervading loving-kindness. There's a couple of Indian Doha verses which make this very clear. In this supreme great bliss, there is no self and there is no other. And in a moment, this supreme great bliss destroys all sorrow. Fantastic. So this great bliss, yes, it's kind of, you know, internally, it's sort of ecstatic for you, but it's love, it's expressed as love, maitri, a metta, very powerful metta for others. So when you start to take in, when you start to breathe in impermanence and death and loss and ending, that will manifest as a keen sense of the preciousness of life, of all life. Not just your own life, but everybody's life. And that will manifest initially in just ordinary, straightforward kindness, friendliness, metta, consideration. And there's an incredibly wonderful verse in the Dhammapada. First page of the Dhammapada, about third or fourth verse down. And when I read this, I know that the Buddha is enlightened. Because he says, others do not know that we are all heading for death. Those who do know it will compose their quarrels. When we know that we are all heading for death, end of quarrelling. No quarrels. No conflict. You don't do anything to bring about quarrels. You compose those quarrels. And then you get later, hatred never ceases through hatred. It only ceases through love. This is an eternal truth. So meditating on this skull bowl filled with nectar is meditating on impermanence and loving kindness. Sometimes, of course, the truth of death just comes like that Vajra thunderbolt straight from the teacher himself. And there's no fancy words about love and all that sort of thing. I'm reminded of once in India with my teacher, with Sangharakshita, when he came back to India in the late 70s, and I was out there. He came out, he was doing these, I'd never seen him, I'd seen him give talks in England, of course, you know, to maybe a room of this size. But in India, you know, he talked to a few thousand people. You know, just incredible. And the atmosphere was very uplifting because people were very, they really expressed their devotion very fully with garlands and all sorts of ways. And we'd come home at night after these talks and, you know, we'd be buzzing and, you know, in a mood one day of great sort of, I was young, great sort of, you know, devotion and gratitude. I said to Bhante as I was giving him his evening hot milk or something, Sangharakshita, oh, Bhante, I don't know what I'll do when you die. And he said, as quick as a flash, like lightning, that's assuming I'll die first. Well, I can tell you, I was out of that room as quick as lightning. And then, you know, for another thing that might start communicating to you are those beautiful robes that I talked about, the blue and the red and the yellow robes. And they really are very beautiful, the way they swirl around him. And of course, this is the Dharma. He's wrapped in the Dharma. It's a lovely saying he has to his disciples, Padmasambhava, wrap yourself in the Dharma. Wrap yourself in the Dharma. So when we meditate on a form like this and you start seeing more deeply into the nature of things, you just want to wrap yourself in the Dharma as fully as possible so that you can share it as fully and as completely as you can with others. And the form isn't static. What you find as you meditate on these forms, at first, you know, you do it exactly as you've been taught. You don't mess around. You don't go off on trips with it. You know, you do it exactly as it's been taught to you by your teacher. But as you go more into it, it might start to change. So sometimes Padmasambhava might be a strong, very handsome man in his prime. Sometimes a 16-year-old youth. Sometimes an 8-year-old boy child with rosy skin speaking strange and cryptic words of wisdom and playfully gesturing. And of course, there's no explanation. There isn't a little voice saying, and now he's taking this form and this symbolizes. No, you have to take it in and go away and reflect deeply on what is being communicated to you. So you're drawn on deeper into the profound meanings that the image is opens up. You might spend years meditating on those long glossy locks. You're just sort of thrilled by them, turned on by them, but you don't know what they mean. They mean something. They're a gateway to something, but it might be a long time before you find out what that is. Not only when you meditate on a form like this, you're not only visualising and imagining, you're feeling the presence of, and in some ways that's more important. You might not, as it were, see anything, but you just have this sense of a sort of presence. And to help you do that, you also recite mantra. The mantra is the sound image, if you like, of the form. You hear that mantra sounding from the space. So in the case of Padmasambhava, the mantra is Om Ahum Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum, and each syllable embodies innumerable meanings which will again show themselves to you. I won't go into all the different meanings of that mantra, that would take too long. Maybe I'll say a little bit. So, Om, Ah, and Hum. This might be a bit technical for some of you, but let's do it for completeness's sake. Om, Ah, and Hum are symbols, mantra symbols, embodying what are known as the three bodies of the Buddha. The Nirmanakaya, the Buddha's presence in the world, if you like. The Sambhogakaya, his dimension of, for want of a better term, archetypal symbols and meanings, archetypal in the original medieval sense, not the Jungian sense, perhaps, and the Dharmakaya, the real nature of the form of the Buddha. So that's Om, Ah, and Hum. And Vajra is their unity, their indestructible unity. Guru is the inner wisdom teacher that you're evoking through the practice. Padma is fearless love and compassion, and Siddhi is the magical power of that love and compassion filling space, and Hum is fulfillment, complete fulfillment. Now you don't think all that when you're doing the mantra in the practice. You would contemplate those meanings outside. In the practice, it's just like a deep drone. It's sometimes described as being like the buzzing of innumerable bees. And it's just this deep, undefined meaning that's coming from this deep drone as you imagine the figure in front of you. So you've got, if you like, the visual aspect and you've got the sound aspect. You've got them both going on. And that, of course, draws you deeper into contemplation of the form. And always, at the end of a practice like this, you let go. It all dissolves away. You don't hold on to it. Even if it's fantastic and you're completely absorbed, it fades away into space. There's no attachment, there's no clinging. The figure dissolves into space. You let it go. You meditate on arising and ceasing, arising and passing away. Things arise and they pass away. Just like rainbows coming into space and going away again. That beautiful, majestic form, like everything else, arises and passes away. And so we're learning to see like that. So meditation on these forms, you're training to see arising and ceasing. No clinging, no attachment, so therefore a much purer loving kindness. It's important too, this dissolving of the figure, because the image of Padmasambhava, the image of any of these images, are not, in this case, Padmasambhava. You know, having evoked for you all this, this picture, I'm going to say that is not Padmasambhava. That isn't. Padmasambhava isn't a man sitting on a flower in the sky, holding lots of things, and wearing too many clothes, who looks a bit fierce. That is not Padmasambhava. The reality of the figure is vast, subtle, unfathomable, capable of any form and any colour, that shows itself in the most surprising ways and places. Well, in fact, in all things, in all beings. When you're deeply into these practices, that spiritual beauty and meaning is in everything and everybody. That's what you learn to see. It's not just something you just do for yourself. You start to see it reflected everywhere as time goes on. And you start to realise that people suffer because they're unaware of that very deep spiritual beauty that they have, that they're not living from that, so they suffer. And you live to bring that forth in others. So a Buddha's love, a Bodhisattva's love and compassion, we use these words, love and compassion, but we don't know what a Buddha's and Bodhisattva's love actually is. We don't actually know. We use those words, but we don't know what it really is. It's a very special kind of quality. The love and compassion of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva is born of seeing that deep spiritual beauty in all beings. And that leads to activity which is natural and spontaneous and unimpeded. Because the Bodhisattva, the Buddha, the Bodhisattva are always aware of that spiritual beauty, because they're never apart from it, they can really enrich the world. They can really enrich the world and others. From a sutra, you're instructed that that you need to develop the Bodhisattva's love that continuously ripens living beings, and the Buddha's love that causes beings to awake. So regular meditation on these beautiful forms, if correctly engaged in, overflows into naturally selfless loving activity. That beauty and meaning is ever present to you in whoever you're with. And you just live to draw that forth, to draw that forth. So I hope this gives you some idea of how important these forms are, how important beauty, imagination, engaging in desire is in spiritual life, how important it is to see deeply and to love well, and that is expressed in energy for the Dharma. And I'm going to end perhaps in a rather strange place, I don't know. About 20 years ago I lived in Bombay for a couple of years. I was part of our Sangha, our spiritual community there, me and some Indian members of our order in India, Indian order members. And we did lots of Dharma work in Bombay. Bombay's a huge city with thousands upon thousands of Buddhists. And we were really turned on. It was a lovely, really lovely Sangha. We were really kind of up for it, just wanting to kind of go out and do lots and lots of communicating the Dharma. We're just sharing our enthusiasm and love for it in all sorts of places, in slum colonies and, tenement blocks, wherever we'd go and do it. And, we really went for it. And, in doing that, it was really important to intensify, as best I could, my own meditation, which was meditating on that figure I've just described. Bombay is a pretty rough city, is a pretty rough and heavy kind of city. I was also at that time reading early translations of Mevrana, Rumi, not the later ones, the early ones, more literal ones. I was sort of, you know, well into all that. And one day, out of all this sort of mixture of things, a very rare kind of mood came on, which became words. And I actually believe it had something to do with meditating on Padmasambhava as well. So I'm going to end with a little thing, these words that I wrote down, called Rumi in Bombay. And it starts with a little quote from Rumi himself. Rumi, the great Persian Sufi. And the quote is, "If I don't see his face, paradise is for me hateful hell." So the words that came out were like this. "We have seen you, beloved, in the amber sun, climbing through the smog haze of morning. Seen you in a scarlet hibiscus trembling by the railway. Seen you in swallows dancing in the pink air of evening above crumbling ochre tenements. And we have seen you, beloved, at night by an open sewer in the wide jet eyes of the slum child, grubby hands folded in prayer. We have seen you, beloved. You make even this wilderness touch paradise." Right.